Welcome to New Books in Biography. I'm Oline Eaton. Writing biography is a challenge, and so writing a dual biography is double that. Today I'm going to be talking with Jean Zimmerman about her new book entitled Love Fiercely, A Gilded Age Romance, which is a dual biography of Edith and Newton Stokes, a couple who were the Brangelina of their age. Hi, Jean. Thank you so much for joining us on New Books in Biography today. I wonder if you could just kick us off by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. I'm a New Yorker. I've been living in the New York area and outside of New York for since I was in college. That's a long time ago. And I started writing books around 25 years ago now, and I've produced a number of different books on different topics just according to what interested me and what I thought I could do and what sources were available. So this is Love Fiercely is the most recent book that I've come out with, and I think it was really fun to work on. It was a great project, and what else would you like to know?
Let's just dive right into the book then. Okay. I wrote this question, but I realize it's like four questions, so feel free to tackle them however you like. I think they are all kind of related. What drew you to this story in particular? And also, this is a dual biography. You've got both Newton and Edith. So what led you to settle on writing a book about both of them rather than just focusing on one of those two individuals?
Okay, that's a good question. That's good questions. what happened was this. For a previous book that focused on a family living in colonial New York, I worked with a map, a really amazing map of the city at that time that was drawn in 1660, and it was really the first street plan of New York. When I was researching this and I was using this map, I discovered that it was in this incredible series of books, six enormous books that together were called The Iconography of Manhattan Island. And I thought, who would come up with this crazy idea and who would execute this? And I learned a little bit about I.N. Phelps Stokes then, but not very much because nobody had produced a real extensive work on the man at that time. So I wanted to find whatever I could about him, and that led me to a painting that he appeared in that was by Sargent and currently hangs in the Metropolitan. And in that painting, he's sort of hanging back in the shadows, and he is he's very much overshadowed by the woman that's with him in the painting. So I went from a map to a man to a painting to a woman, and the woman was Edith, his wife. And it became a story of two people rather than one person, in which each of them played an equal role.
Where does the title come from?
Well, I wanted it to be a sort of a letter from Fiercely, which was Edith's childhood nickname, and she was a fierce person throughout her life. She was very independent. She was determined. She had a lot of experiences, and I wanted that to be prominent in the title.
So by way of an introduction to these two characters, Edith and Newton, can you tell us a bit about their childhoods and the relationship between their families?
Sure. Well, the very wealthy in those days were really one big family. So they knew each other from childhood. They both had houses, their families both had houses on Staten Island. And so they knew each other when they were growing up. From there, they both moved back into New York City, back into Manhattan. And their families were attached to each other throughout their lives, but they sort of drifted apart until later. They attended the same dancing schools. They went to the same places. They would have attended the theater together and that kind of thing. But they weren't really involved until they were in their mid-20s.
And the Minterns fell on hard times around the time of Edith's coming out, right?
That's right. At the time of her debut, the father had a setback, and it was very serious. They didn't know whether or not the family would recover, and so it ended up with her, instead of wearing silk for her debut, like all the other girls did, she had to wear cotton, and it was, it was a formative experience for her. The family did recover and reattained their former wealth. So it wasn't a lifelong tragedy for her, but I think it did cause her to think about the state of wealth and the state of her wealth, and what could happen to people.
Do you think that shaped her proclivity for philanthropy later on?
Yeah, I think it probably did. I mean, she and Newton both went through their lives both rich and reformers. And, you know, a number of people did that in those days, but they did it probably more than some others. And she spent a lot of her life helping society in various ways, whether it was through the University Settlement Society or the Kindergarten Association or being an advocate of women's rights at that time. So I think that probably her early experience did shape her.
So one of Edith's big claims to fame is that her image was used for Big Mary at the Chicago World's Fair in 1892. Can you talk a bit about how she became involved in this? Because it's kind of scandalous for a single young woman at the time, and what the effect of the statue was.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, she, Daniel Chester French had a studio in New York City at that time, and their circles would have crossed in those days. And she, they both attended a series of soirees at shared acquaintances. House at that time, and so they would have known each other. She had a propensity to appear in what was called a tableau vivant at that time, which was kind of a parlor game that the young ladies and some men of the upper crust participated in, where they would act out either a scene from the Bible or a famous painting, and they would do it in a stationary way, posing within kind of a frame, a big frame, like a big picture frame, as I said, at a party. So she had experience posing, and she was known as somebody that took part in these tableau vivant, and I think that's probably how he got to know her. But as you said, it was if not scandalous per se, I don't think that it was a scandal for her to pose for him, but even so, it was something that not every young woman would do at that time. I mean, she was posing in a Greek toga-like outfit in his studio with bare arms, and when he executed the statue, which was 65 feet tall and was very apparent at the World's Fair, and there were thousands upon thousands of people streaming underneath it every day. There she was. You know, it was a likeness of her, and her family and friends would have been very aware of her participation in this. So that took some guts to do that.
Yeah. And then the image also kind of went viral, right? It can still be seen in different statues today.
Right, absolutely. There were some gentlemen who decided that they wanted to take the likeness of the Republic to New York City, and so they got a smaller version of it made. They brought it to New York, and they put it up in a famous department store at that time, on the Ladies' Mile, which was where all of the department stores were, and it was there in the middle of a fountain in New York where everybody could see it as they came by, and that must have been pretty funny also, I think, for her to see that this place where she was accustomed to going all the time, I'm sure, to do her own shopping, that there she was right in the middle of the floor like that.
So how did Newton come back into Edith's life as a romantic character?
Well, he had wooed her over the years. He had to work to win her. She was friendly with him, but she wasn't impressed by his wealth, which was his family's wealth far exceeded her family's wealth, for one thing. But she wasn't impressed by that, or she didn't appear to be. They had danced with each other at various parties, and he had sent her flowers on occasion, but she wasn't really rising to the bait. At one point, she went to a New Year's party, a New Year's weekend party at his family's home, which was a huge 100-room home in the Berkshires, and she went with her family to go to a ball there over the weekend, and he proposed to her. She turned him down. He left rather than making more of an effort. He went back to Paris, where he was studying, and sent her letters. She didn't respond. And finally, very romantically, I think, her sister decided to take matters into her own hands and sent a little snippet of a picture of Edith's face to Newton in Paris and said, come and get her. Somehow she knew that Edith, you know, maybe Edith had confided in her that she actually was more interested than it appeared. And so he came rushing back to Quebec, where her family was at that time, and spent a few weeks there, proposed, she finally accepted, and they were married about 2 months later.
I want to bring you back around, though, because can you talk a bit more about the refusal? Because you really do a good job in the book of putting this in context of that. Obviously, it's a big deal to have your marriage proposal turned down now, but in Victorian times, it was had such social importance.
Right, it was. It was. I mean, that's not. It's not something that a woman really should do. I mean, she was. She here. They were a perfect match, and he was. He was sort of the ideal mate in a certain way. So the refusal was really. How can I say it? Emasculating, I guess, in a certain way, and it was something that people really. They talked about, there were cartoons that illustrated the refusal and all the reasons why a man would be refused, whether because he was not nice to look at or he didn't have enough money or, you know, all the different reasons why somebody would be refused. So it was something that was definitely sort of a, a lightning rod at that time.
So Edith and Newton married during the Gilded Age. What was the status of women during this time?
Well, it was complex. It was changing. There were women, the word feminism had not yet made its appearance on our shores at that time. But the idea of women's rights was becoming known, and the new woman, who was somebody very much like Edith, was a person that either was admired or detested, depending on who you were. And women were doing a lot of athletic things that they hadn't done before. They were going out into the workplace in a way they hadn't before. I mean, even just the very idea of a woman on a bicycle could be a very politically charged symbol at that time. And of course, women were working on getting the right to vote, although that wouldn't come to pass for some years. But it was already underway, and that's something that Edith participated in when she went with her mother and sister to a convention in Albany to try to get the vote for women. But, of course, it didn't pass.
After their marriage, they moved to Paris. What were they doing there?
Well, he was studying architecture. She was learning French, apparently. I don't know if she was doing a whole lot more than that. But they were young and in love, and they were enjoying being together. It was their honeymoon, really, more than anything else. And he wanted to pursue his career, and so he was working in various ateliers at the time. And they were just beginning their lives together.
So how did they get involved with John Singer Sargent?
That was through a family friend. And somebody, a mutual acquaintance, approached him and said, could you paint her portrait? And he said, I would be delighted to, but it was very difficult because it was not something that was easy for him to accomplish. His schedule was extremely busy at that time. He was beginning to work on the murals for the Boston Public Library, which are immense. And so he didn't know whether he'd be able to do it. His schedule slightly cleared up. He said, okay, I can. It was supposed to be a wedding present for the two of them from a family friend, and it cost a great deal of money, but their friends could afford this. So he said, if you come to me in London, then I will paint your portrait. And so that's what they did. They went and they spent, I believe it was 6 weeks altogether in London, and he started to work on Edith's portrait.
So can you describe the sitting process and the evolution of the portrait itself? Because it was
sure.
quite arduous.
Sure. Well, she sat, they called it sitting to a painter. So she sat to Sargent, now I'm trying to remember exactly how many times it was. It was, I believe, 25 times. And so that's including when he started on her face, he started on her dress. He was making some progress. And then what happened is that he didn't like how it was coming out. And he said he was basically, or it seemed as though he was going to throw in the towel. And so they went away one day, very discouraged and thinking, oh no, we're not going to have this after all. But they came back for the next appointment and tried to find something else for Edith to wear because he hadn't been happy with this blue gown that she had been wearing. And she was very flushed and perspiring slightly. And she was wearing casual clothes that looked like the clothes that a young woman might wear to play tennis in those days, or possibly to go bicycling. And he looked at her and he said, I want to paint you just as you are. And so that's how she ended up looking so casual, modern, strong, all the things that her portrait turned into. And not only that, but at one point, they were supposed to have a greyhound dog that was going to be a prop for her to lean her hand on, and the dog didn't materialize. Its owner had taken it out of town or something like that. And so Sargent decided to have Newton pose in the picture as well. And that's how he becomes sort of a foil for her, somewhat in the shadows of that portrait.
In the book, you mentioned that the portrait offered, quote, a new female paradigm. And it's obviously a very stark contrast to Sargent's other portraits that he'd done before that. But how does it offer, can you explain this a little bit?
Sure. Well, as I said, you know, she's standing straight out front with this look on her face of bright, beautiful, active, vivid, you know, everything that her face is. You know, I love Sargent's work, and I love his more traditional portraits of women, but nothing looks like Edith does in this portrait. Also, she's wearing a jacket that has very broad shoulders, and she's wearing a bow tie, which exactly matches her husband's bow tie, a black bow tie. Her skirt is enormous and takes up a lot of space in the canvas. And she's holding a boater hat, and she's holding it, something that I think is very interesting. She's holding it right at crotch level of her husband. And I think that this is something that people who were very sensitive to the relations between the sexes in those days, it was perceived as somewhat threatening at first when the painting was first shown. She was described in reviews as the new woman, the American girl, and everybody knew that she was very much of the present, but as I said, that could be a bit threatening. And then, oddly enough, as the painting toured and was shown around the country, a completely different perspective was shared on it by various reviewers, and people thought that it was brilliant and the most remarkable thing that Sargent had ever done. So I think it was really on the cusp of a change at that time of how women were perceived, and the painting was right in the middle of it.
There's also another famous portrait of her by Cecilia Beau. Can you describe that one in contrast to the Sargent painting?
Well, it's a bit different because it's more still and it's quieter, but it shows a look, I think, of great intelligence on her face and great focus. She's holding a book with her finger in it as though it's just marking the page, and she's about to go back to her reading. And so it shows her beauty, and it shows her character, but she doesn't look like she's about to jump across the canvas with a tennis racket or anything like that. So it's different.
I'm sorry, there was some sort of, I think the phone was twisted or something. Can we go back and do that one again?
Yeah, sure. Okay, so I was talking about the Beau portrait.
Yeah, how is the Beau portrait different?
Yeah. Well, the Beau portrait shows Edith from a quieter perspective, and she has a look of intelligence and kind of self-assertion on her face, but she's very much in one place. She's not moving, she's not athletic, she's not about to run across the room with a tennis racket or anything like that. He's holding a book, and her finger is holding her place in the book, and so she's about to go back to it. So it shows kind of a different intellectual side of Edith. But, you know, it's equally attractive, I think.
She was often ill after their marriage, and yet she still managed to play an active role in social reforms, in particular in the development of kindergartens in the city, right?
Right, she did. Mm-hmm. You know, she worked when she could. She had a series of events, I guess, you know, with her heart. She had high blood pressure throughout her life, and she had other members of her family that had the same problem, and other people had had strokes, and, you know, it was difficult for her, and she had to go and take rest cures at various places, and people, you know, doctors, a lot of doctors were sort of quacks at that time, and they prescribed cures that you really would not want to subject somebody to, but she did her best, and she soldiered on, and she did engage in this activity with the Kindergarten Association, which at that time was really quite radical. It was kindergartens were not something as they are today that everybody assumes and that are in every school. They were not in any school, and these people were really reformers and wanted to give children a better shot from the very beginning, especially the children of immigrant parents. So it was quite extraordinary work that she did.
We've talked a lot about Edith, so let's focus on Newton a bit.
Sure.
It comes up more than once in Love Fiercely that Newton was quite a dandy and prone to paying almost obsessive attention to the details of his clothes. I think he, throughout the whole thing, he emerges as quite a quirky figure. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Sure. Well, you know, I think that was an element of his character, that he was a bit of a dandy from when he was a teenager on. And if you look at photographs of him when he was older, he has a very pointed beard, and he's got hair that's severely parted in the middle. And that's not something that was that unusual in those days, but he's very unusual looking. He was, from the very beginning of his life, he was obsessed with various things, whether it was inventions or collecting motorcycles or cars or boats, or, you know, he could afford to collect quite a bit, you could imagine. But he was always quite an intellectual. He studied architecture. He wanted to be an architect, but in particular, he wanted to be an architect that would focus on reform and would focus on cleaning up tenements and producing new sanitary tenements. So he was a serious person, very serious, and he turned from one activity to another until he discovered really the love of his intellectual life, and that was the iconography of Manhattan Island.
Which is obviously worthy of an interview all into itself, but can you briefly tell us a bit about it, and in particular how it consumed his life and altered his relationship with Edith?
Yeah, that is a big question. The iconography of Manhattan Island was a book. It was originally going to be a small book, and he got the idea to produce it in 1909. And by the time it was finished in 1928, there were six volumes, each one a significant doorstop. And the whole collection, the whole enterprise had to do with maps and views, which are simply another word for landscapes. And page after page after page of writing about Manhattan. It really shows everything there is to know about Manhattan from the earliest times up to his present. There's never been anything like it, and there never will be anything like it. And it's been something that researchers and writers have depended on since it was produced. And yet it's something that is not as well known as it could be, because it's hard to find. You don't really find it unless you're in a research library. Nobody owns this thing, although I have a copy of it, but very few people have it in their own home.
And how did his work on that for all those years, how did that affect his relationship with Edith?
Well, it was quite a... it was a distraction from his marriage. It was a distraction from his relationship. He got more and more absorbed in this project, more and more obsessed with collecting. He spent, I think, probably almost every waking minute in his study, which for a long time was in the New York Public Library. He had an office there. And he had a staff that worked with him, but he began to feel as though it had to be the most all-encompassing project that there ever was. And so this did have an effect. It had an effect on his health. He had health problems throughout his life. And so he had a number of sort of mini breakdowns as this went along, both him and Edith did. And it was, it was very difficult. It was consuming. And yet it was an extraordinary experience for him.
I also want to touch upon, and he brought the Tudor mansion over from Ipswich to America, which was an extremely funny and whimsical story.
Right. Okay. Well, he and Edith decided that they had a farm in Greenwich. It was a kind of a weekend farm. And, they were thinking about remodeling their farm, and they came across a picture of a magazine of, an old Tudor, farmhouse, in Suffolk in England. And it was called High Low, and they decided they just had to have this this house on their own property. And so they had it shipped to the piers at Greenwich in 688 packing cases. It was all dismantled. They got it. They put it back together again, and they loved it. It was beautiful. It was an amazing property. But it looks very much like merry old England, put into the Greenwich countryside. Greenwich was all countryside at that time.
And it's the oldest house in America, right?
Yeah, it was, and he was very proud to say that.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us today about Love Fiercely. I know it's a dreadful question to ask an author when their book's only just come out, but do you have any idea what you'll be writing next?
Well, actually, I have another book coming out, oddly enough, in June. It's a novel, which I've never written before, so that's an unusual experience for me. And it's called The Orphan Master, and it's a historical novel, a historical murder mystery that takes place in old New York in 1663 Manhattan. So that's coming out soon.
Were you able to use some of your research from this?
Yes,
for that?
Absolutely. Great. Absolutely. From the iconography, mm-hmm. and also from a previous book. Yeah, I was able to use it all. I was really happy about that.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Bye bye.
I've been talking today with Jean Zimmerman about her new book entitled Love Fiercely, A Gilded Age Romance. I'm Oline Eaton. This is New Books and Biography. Thanks for listening.